Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today I'm talking with Camila Taylor. She is doing an engineering residence at Hustle, and she also does the Tech Beach Retreat, which is a international technology summit hosted in Jamaica. But before this, you were a senior software engineer at LinkedIn. You worked on the LinkedIn app, the LinkedIn Learning app. You worked at Wolfram on Mathematica with Lego Mindstorms. I mean, this is all my favorite things in one place. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm super excited to talk to you because you've done a bunch of stuff over your career.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah. Thank you. The thing is, though, I'm looking and I see iOS and I'm like, okay, that's cool. She's a Swift developer or maybe Objective-C. And then I go back and I look in the past and then it looks like you're working on low-level stuff on Lego Mindstorms. Can we start at Lego Mindstorms? What was going on there?
Yeah. So the Lego Mindstorms job, this is my first job after I dropped out of my PhD program / took a year off, which I knew meant that I was not going to go back.
So you're ABD?
Yeah. No, I dropped out before that. I was 3 years in. Okay. So I finished the master's degree and then I peaced out. it was a really good sort of coincidence or a scenario because I had done so much Lego Mindstorms in my past. I that was what got me into programming in high school. I did this camp in Jamaica where I was helping teaching it. And then I used it, in my research in grad school. And so by a really fortuitous set of events, there is a manager at Wolfram who had long wanted to be able to program Mathematica using Lego Mindstorms. And they came by the campus and I was like, oh, well, it just so happens that I'm looking for a job and I've done lots of stuff with Lego Mindstorms. And so I actually, my first day on the job, I had like my laptop on my desk and I had a Lego Mindstorms kit. And my mom was like, oh, well, finally, after all these years like that I've spent like all this money on Legos, it finally got you a job. I'm really excited. But yeah.
That's amazing. So you've been doing this a while. Like you were doing Lego Mindstorms like 13 years ago. So then like fast forward and then you're sitting at Wolfram, like at a job, you're getting money and there's Legos on your desk.
Yeah.
I mean, that is the dream.
It really was a dream. Sort of like pitch me. Is this real? Is this happening? Actually getting paid to do this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, did they just give you the task and say, all right, figure out how these are going to talk to each other? Or had the architecture or the decisions been made before?
No, it was pretty much, this is something we want to do. We don't really know how to do it. We assume you'll be able to figure out how to do it. And the theory was that at this point, Mathematica, the previous version they'd released had a bunch of computer vision and image processing stuff. And so this was their play at like, okay, well, we have this part. And so we feel like we could start to get people interested in using this if we added more and more functionality, right? It'd be sort of a complete set of features for you. And so, yeah, it was pretty much this like jump in the weeds. At first, I thought it would be fine because I knew that Lego had opened, they had sort of released some SDKs and stuff to communicate with it. But it turns out they hadn't really updated any of it for about 6 years. And so when you mentioned like I was doing low level stuff, it was because, after a while, and you know, we were like able to sort of partially communicate with, the Mindstorms and sort of partially read sensor readings, but it wasn't quite working. And this is on the Mac and then on Linux, we're like, okay, we're going to do this on Linux as well. And we have to like do this driver from scratch. And it worked fine on Linux. And that was when we realized that actually it was a driver that was broken. And so we're like, okay, well, I guess we're going to have to write this for Mac as well. That's how I ended up having to do both like the USB and sort of Bluetooth drivers. And that was also my first experience with Objective-C, was needing to write that.
Why did you have to do drivers? If your goal is to get this amazing high-level language and the way that Mathematica thinks about stuff to talk to the robot, why couldn't you call Lego and say, hey, you know, y'all need to fix this or whatever?
Yeah, if we tried, they weren't really very responsive, if I remember correctly. And I think part of that, and this is something I didn't know at the time, was that they were actually working on the new version, the EV3, right? So this was at the time of the NXT. Mm-hmm. But unbeknownst to us, many of the features and functionality that we wanted was actually going into the EV3. And so I think they had just like stopped supporting the NXT at that point. And that was why we were having trouble getting that. But without us knowing that sort of like product roadmap, there was no way for us to know that this was why we were not getting a lot of help.
Mm-hmm. And you had said you'd spent your time in high school working on Legos, mm-hmm. and was that your foray into programming?
Kind of. So I technically first programmed, and this is in maybe third or fourth grade in Jamaica. We had a very eager computer teacher who taught us Logo. I don't know if you remember that programming language.
Oh,
the triangle.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's technically my first programming experience. But I would say that my Lego Mindstorm So kit was maybe really my first programming experience in high school. And then mm-hmm. I moved around a bunch. I'm from Jamaica, but I went to middle school and high school in Atlanta, Georgia. And I was at a magnet school in Atlanta, and they had an advanced Mac technology class, I think they called it. And the teacher was mm-hmm. basically using Lego Mindstorms to teach us a bunch of stuff. And so that's really when I started to learn how to program.
Interesting. So that was your first kind of, I don't know, real experience, like legit.
Yeah.
Like Logo is, I think of it like, you know, it's loops, right? Mm-hmm. It's all about teaching looping, isn't it? And maybe functions.
Yeah.
Then when you get into Mindstorms, is it true that the Mindstorms brick, the main brain, it's a little Linux machine, isn't it?
I think so. Or I think it's ARM, if I remember correctly. Yeah. It's like an ARM processor, and then it has like a really small, I'd have to double check with the EV3. The NXT, I think, was like a really simple like OS that they had on there.
Oh.
Yeah.
Super basic. You're right. I think that it was the next one that became a real little computer, like a real machine.
Mm-hmm.
EV3,
I think. Yeah. EV3. I'm saying I think, that's like, I don't have one that I'm looking at right now.
No, I totally understand.
Yeah.
The reason I'm trying to understand is that I'm teaching my kids, quote unquote, how to program.
Yeah.
And it's JavaScript and it's Python. But then my 9-year-old came in yesterday and saw me building this little Raspberry Pi Kubernetes swarm that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. And we ended up talking about traceroute and ping and SSH. And he kept asking all kinds of questions that I realized it was him moving his brain to another level in the stack.
Yeah.
Which made me realize that he is now noticing that there is a stack.
Uh-huh.
And that's kind of what I wanted to talk to you about, is that shift when you're sitting there and you're trying to get Mathematica, which is arguably quite a high level thing, to talk to this low level thing. And then you discover that the abstraction leaked.
Mm-hmm.
The USB drivers were the problem, and now you're debugging, you know, how you communicate on the wire.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting too. Yeah. Because at first we were very focused on like, what is the language? Like, what is the syntax, the functions that we're going to expose to people to be able to get us to work? And so we're simultaneously sort of adding to like the Mathematica or Wolfram language. But mm-hmm. also having to, as you said, like work in the lower stack, like, wait, like this is not like something is broken in this communication. It's sort of interesting. And I think perhaps like, studying robotics in grad school, I guess, sort of helped me feel sort of comfortable around like moving along the stack.
I feel like there is I was going to say a class of programmer, but class isn't the right word. Mm-hmm. Some of us who program might program 10, 15 years and never really move up or down within the stack. Like I know devs that are amazing programmers and they can write, you know, full apps or full systems even, but they've never written a USB driver in C.
Yeah.
They've never, you know, and as you go forward in time, what skills can we develop? What ways can we think about technology that would give us more flexibility that we could, in fact, switch stacks?
Yeah, I think so. I think that a computer science degree, that really should be one of the things that you get from it. I know there's a lot of, you know, there's definitely a lot of useful things that you get from online learning, online classes, boot camps, et cetera. But the real sort of value, one of the real values that I think you should be getting from a computer science degree is the ability to sort of move around the stack and see what those connections are, right? And I think it's not that far of a jump from I had to figure out how to write this USB and Bluetooth driver to years later, I had to figure out how to write something in the networking stack for an iOS app, right? These things are like definitely very, very related. You have to think about things in very similar ways.
Yeah. When I teach at the local community college, there's an exploring engineering class that I do, and they kind of, they bring in guest lecturers. And one of the things that I attempt to do is let, you know, to kind of open the stack up to people. So for example, I might open up Paint and make a bitmap that's like 100 by 100 and put red in it and then save the bitmap and then look at the hex.
Yeah.
And you should, it's just a bitmap, not a JPEG. It'll be FF0000, FF0000, repeated.
Yeah.
And the idea being to get people to go, wait a second, what's there's something underneath that?
Yeah.
You know? And then they go, well, that's very inefficient. And then we talk about compression, et cetera, right?
Oh, yeah. It's sort of teaching by like sort of showing what's happening as opposed to like just teaching sort of the theory of something, right? These are two different ways.
Right. And I'm hearing you say that your computer science background from graduate school all the way back was about the stack, about talking about the pieces from the bottom up and making sure that there's at least a fundamental understanding of like, okay, well, there is low level networking and we sit on top of that.
Yeah.
And then we sit on top of that, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I think so. Or at the very least, I think that's how I think about things. And maybe I'm giving a little bit too much credit. I'm not sure. But I very much, even if you think of say like mobile development, I think of that as little mini like full stack development operations, because you again sort of have to think all the way like up and down a stack, and sometimes you do have to debug things that are going on with like different sensor readings, etc., networking layer. And I think it's I think it's a really important skill to be able to do that. Not necessarily everyone has to do that, but I think it's a really interesting way or a really useful skill in being able to understand holistically what's happening.
Mm-hmm. So you and I'm just going to compare us because we're the ones on the podcast, have different educational backgrounds, right? So you went right up against the edge of a PhD. And I started out in a community college and then at night eventually got a bachelor's degree.
Yeah.
But while I was working, I was thinking about like, I feel like something's missing. So I chose consciously to go and finish my bachelor's because I felt that it filled in holes in my understanding of the stack.
Yeah.
What do you and I say to people who are what we would call maybe non-traditional learners or self-taught learners who have learned everything online, and they might be listening to us and saying, oh, look at these two privileged people talking about how they have fancy degrees. I don't need to know any of that. I can get it all on the web.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. For most of the things that I use now, I've learned them after school, right? There was no iOS when I was in school, right? The iPhone was announced in the senior year of my undergrad. And so there's a lot of like technology has just like changed so much in the last 10 years that I think that's also a really important skill. And that's maybe an advantage. If you have been self-taught, if you have learned everything online, then you're used to mm-hmm. that mode of learning in a way that maybe you're not used to that if you've only gone to school. So, you know, I think this is it's a super valuable skill set.
Mm-hmm. So you did Legos in high school. Mm-hmm. You worked at Wolfram, mm-hmm. moving your way across the stack, programming across the stack. How did you find yourself as a mid-level Java developer?
Yeah. So about a year into Wolfram, a couple of things happened. One was that I'd sort of been evaluating on if this was the path that I wanted to do. And I was like, yes, I definitely enjoy this much more than academia. This is the right thing for me. And there's like another thing at this point, right? I'm in Illinois and as I said, I'm from Jamaica and I was pretty much done with the winter. And so I knew I'd wanted, and in fact, before I joined Wolfram, I'd almost moved to California. I was going to take a position at Honda Research and that would have been like really going for robotics all the way. But I was sort of uncomfortable with how difficult it had been to find a non-military, robotics job. A lot of robotics research and even robotics in industry has gotten a lot of funding mm-hmm. from the Department of Defense, especially at that time. And that was one of the reasons why I decided to go with Wolfram over Honda Research. And that's something I think was like absolutely the right decision. But then I was like, okay, now I really want to move out to the Bay Area. And there were a couple of other things. So, and this is, again, like I said, this is sort of my test of whether or not I would do robotics full-time in industry. And I knew that there are a lot of issues with funding robotics projects at companies. And sure enough, the robotics project got basically like defunded after about a year when my manager had to leave the company for personal reasons. And so it does still live on. Actually, they have a more generic devices project that they released a year or two later. And that's sort of where that lives on, and still being able to use Mathematica to communicate with and program any sort of generic hardware device that you have connected to your computer. Mm-hmm. But it was basically sort of the writing on the wall. I was like, okay, well, if this project is done and I know I want to move out to California, I'm just going to go for it. And so I applied to a couple of places out here. I really enjoyed the experience when I interviewed at LinkedIn, and they apparently enjoyed it as well. And so that's how I ended up out here. And when I came, as I said, I'd spent a lot of time debugging USB and Bluetooth drivers. And so when they asked me what I wanted to work on, I was like, I really need to move away from being this low level for a while. And mm-hmm. so that's how I ended up working on the main stack. LinkedIn is a Java shop. So that's how that basically worked out.
So from a career management perspective, you made a conscious decision to say, I want to exercise this different part of my brain, this different part of my skill set, and get me out of the low-level USB debugging.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting. I mean, if you've worked in that part of the stack, it can be a lot to sort of be working at that level, like day after day. You do get wins, but they're sort of like far and few between. And in between that, there's lots of sort of like debugging, like error statements and like lots and lots and lots of Google searches to try to figure out like what exactly is like happening. And you get a really nice payoff when things work. But in between that, there's just like a mm-hmm. lot of pain. And so I was mostly like ready to move away from that level of pain for a while. And try out long stretches of
looking at hex.
Exactly. And, yeah.
trying and reminding yourself, you know, it's not nearly as glamorous as when they did it on the Matrix. And they're like, yeah, look, I can see in the Matrix. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's not like that at all. Looking at hex does not make me feel like that in any way.
No, it really doesn't. So, yeah. Okay.
So you moved up, and at this point, is Apple starting to go and make that Objective-C to Swift change? Because you were at LinkedIn for over 3 years.
Five and a half years, actually.
Five and a half years, pardon me.
Over half a decade, someone recently said to me, which...
1/20th of a century.
Yeah, yeah. All of those make it sound really, really long. So this was... this was around the time when I joined LinkedIn. It was around the time that I think both LinkedIn and Facebook were starting to believe that their non-native JavaScript approach to building apps is like perhaps like not super performant. And I think both companies came to that realization around the same time. And so I was on the main stack, as I said. I was working on the profile. That was when LinkedIn rebuilt on the profile. And so that was a really great project. And when it was done, I sort of got the like, okay, here are all the things that the team is doing right now. And they mentioned a new app called Contacts. And that was LinkedIn's first non-main app. So the first in their family of apps that they built. And, there's one person on the team and I was like, oh, well, I like Apple devices. Sure, I'll do that. I was like, I had definitely been sort of interested in it for a while and had wanted to spend time sort of learning it and hadn't had like the time. And so this seemed like the perfect time to do that. So my manager said, sure. And then he sort of, I think this will be a really good decision. I think mobile is going to be big for LinkedIn in a couple of years. Just like the understatement of the decade, maybe, because mobile, you know, by about a year or two after that, I think LinkedIn was around like 50% traffic going through mobile. We weren't there at the time when I started at all.
The app revolution happened and they were right to do that.
Right. Yeah. And so we were on Objective-C and that was also around the time that the LinkedIn app, as I said, decided to rewrite into Objective-C. And so I did this other app and then we launched that and then they went into a sort of down phase as they tried to figure out like how the app was performing, what to do, how to react. And it was during that phase that and a reorg that happened that I ended up moving on to the main flagship app. And then I worked on that for, I guess, about 3.5 years or so.
How big is a team? I mean, that's a big deal app. Like that's a non-trivially sized app. It's an important app.
Yeah.
What's a team size on something like that?
Oh man. Right now, gosh, I would say, so I know at the peak, one of our peaks of development, and that was when we rebuilt the app in Swift. And that was probably had around 50, so like definitely at least 50, maybe over 50 people committing to the iOS app alone every day.
Wow.
Yeah. At the time, it was much smaller. So when I first started doing mobile at LinkedIn, I think I was one of like a handful of iOS developers. And because I ended up doing it so early, that means that I got to be around for like the mobilization phase of LinkedIn. And that happened so I joined in 2012, switched over to the flagship app in 2013. So it was in 2014 that the company started this like company-wide mobilize effort to train more developers in iOS. And because it was like not possible to hire people fast enough. And I think the whole industry was sort of hurting for trying to like hire enough mobile developers. And so because of that, I got to be on the end of, I was helping to train other iOS developers. And I think that's really when I started to realize that like I was able to help other people and they were becoming their own iOS developers. That's when I started to think of myself as like, oh, like I'm a little bit more senior now. Like I've learned something in the last year and a half.
Yeah. It's funny how it's a gradient and it just kind of sneaks up on you. And then there's just a day, there's a random Tuesday where you're like, well, I actually do know what I'm doing. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. 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 So that was in, 2014, and 2014 is also, I believe, when Swift was announced, right? In that summer. Mm-hmm. And it was around that time that we had been sort of making a lot of noise about the app. You know, the app, when it was originally architected, as they said, was for like not as a native app. And it was for a sort of different era of apps. And we were just hitting against like all sorts of code smell, technical debt. It was taking a lot longer to release features. And so we had been pushing for be able to rewrite the app for a bit by this. And around the time design was also in product, they were also pushing for a bunch of new changes. And the two things sort of came to head. And it was sort of like, well, like, if we really want to do this, we are also going to need a rewrite. And so we got this rewrite approved, and we're having like discussions about what our technical stack is. And then like Swift is announced. And it all, it sort of all happened around the same time. And we had this sort of thing where we're like, well, we don't rewrite the app all the time. Like, what are we going to do? Like, are we going to do the rewrite in Objective-C, or are we going to do the rewrite in Swift? And we ultimately voted to do the rewrite in Swift. And, that's how we ended up doing the Swift, adopting Swift the next year.
Wow. Technology moves fast.
It moves fast. Yeah. it was really a bunch of things sort of happened at the same time. And there was a worry that, we weren't sure, like, what the support was going to be for Objective-C, or how much we were going to start feeling left out, if we didn't adopt Swift. And it seemed like a really tempting opportunity to be able to start a brand new code base, and also to be able to do it in this new language.
Mm-hmm. One thing that we talked about before that we wanted to make sure we covered on the podcast was an interesting ism. Sometimes on the podcast, we've talked about the different levels of privilege, and we've talked about being a man in tech, being a woman in tech, being a person of color in tech. But you said that recently you had a conversation with someone about ageism, but maybe not the kind of ageism that people usually think of.
Yeah, they're asking about what I thought about ageism in tech. And to be totally clear, like, that's definitely something that I suffer from in the tech industry, right? There's a whole thing of, like, you need to be, like, a young genius, you know, recent college dropout or graduated from like the right university. But I actually think that, for many of us women in tech, we suffer from reverse ageism. When I joined LinkedIn, I think I had been at the company for about a year, and someone had joined the company, and she was talking to me, and she was like, "Oh yeah. So like, you just graduated, right?" And I was like, "No, I just did a PhD. Like, I've been working for like 3 years now." Like, I just felt like she just like subtracted like 5 or 6 years of like experience that I'd had like completely away from me. And it's sort of funny because, and I've talked to other friends about this. You know, I have a friend who, she's a VP of engineering at a startup, and she's in her mid-30s now, and regularly people assume that she's in her 20s, and ironically they may like defer to say like the CTO at the company, who is actually in his mid-20s, right? And they like do like, it's a very interesting sort of thing where they like, it's fine for him to look young and be young, but for her, like, if they think that she's young, then they're like automatically giving her less respect.
I'm not trying to dance around this, but I'm trying to make sure I pick the right words.
Yeah.
Is this a, for lack of another word, men are not very good at maintaining themselves or moisturizing or whatever. Like, you know, I'm over 40, but if I shave, I could maybe pass for 35. But if I don't, I've got gray in my beard, and someone might assume I'm 45.
Yeah.
You on the other hand, could easily pass for 25, and that could cause you problems from a career perspective when someone doesn't realize you've been doing this for 15 years.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting because, so I think there's definitely an interesting sort of race aspect to this. And, you know, I know I get this from my mom. My mom like tells me all the time that when she was pregnant with me, that people used to give my dad like side eyes and like dirty looks, because they thought that he had like knocked up this woman who was like way younger than them, when in reality there's like 2-3 years between them, right? But she just looks so much younger than she is. And my friend I was just mentioning, right, like, she's Asian, etc. And I think there's like a fair amount of people like from different races where you often look younger than your age. And it's sort of, it's an interesting kind of like intersectional thing where you cross like being a woman in tech and maybe people assuming that you don't have as much experience, and then also looking younger your age for various reasons, genetics, whatever it is. You end up in this scenario where sometimes you're around for a while and people make a lot of assumptions about what you do or do not know.
Right. There are definitely, there are genetic aspects of things. Yeah. There are, as you say, there are potentially racial issues. My wife is from Zimbabwe. She's black. Mm-hmm. She's in her mid 40s as well, but she recently started a new career as a nurse.
Yeah.
Everyone assumes she's 25.
Oh, interesting.
And this isn't like, sometimes it's flattering, mm-hmm. but sometimes it's like, you know, as though when they hear that she has a 12-year-old son and they think she's 25, then a lot of really weird assumptions happen. And they also forget that she's got an MBA uh-huh. and you know, other advanced degrees. And then she says that you can see a visual shift in their posture and their behavior towards her mm-hmm. when they literally go, whoop, oh, you're 20 years older than I thought you were. You are almost double.
Yeah.
And then from an experience perspective, it's like, oh, I thought you had 2 years experience. You have 10 times that.
Yeah. I even.
And then they behave differently around
you. Oh, absolutely. I actually, I waited a while to get my driver's license. And when I finally did, I actually failed it the first time. And, the instructor gave me this weird feedback. He said, oh, I think you're moving your hands on the steering wheel too much. I was like, what does that even mean? And so I went back to my driving instructor and I did one more thing. And he was like, I don't know what that means. Go back. Hopefully you'll get like somebody else. But of course, you know, I'm in Champaign, Illinois and I got the same guy again. And this time he made this comment near the beginning. And the first time he'd been sort of furiously taking notes the whole time. And this time he looked at me and he goes, oh, so are you cutting school? And I looked at him and I said, no, I work at Wolfram Research, but, you know, and so I'm just coming in late today. And he goes, oh, and his entire demeanor shifted. He stopped taking notes. Mm. And this is again, like less than a week since like the first time. And he passed me. He just like assumed that I was a high schooler and was like grading me on this like extra curve because he thought that I was 17 and I was about to like crash my car or something. I don't know what it was. Like it was very interesting to see like that shift, like the same person.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Well, that is all the time we have, but I really appreciate you chatting with me today about, you know, programming across the stack.
Oh, yeah. Thanks. Time flew by.
It surely did.
Yeah.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.